welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 218 of the podcast, and it's 22nd of May 2015 as I record this. And today I have a fantastic interview with Michael Brent Collings, who is, like every other horror author I know, super lovely and funny, and we just had a brilliant time. So stick around if you want to giggle along with us. We do talk about writing darker stuff and depression, but we still manage to be happy about it. And also Michael Brent's tips on screenwriting and making a full-time living as a writer. And I'm really a fan of his books, which I've discovered recently. So yeah, stick around for that. But big news first up, and I can't quite believe I'm doing this, because I have a fear of being tied down. You may have realized this. I have a bit of an independent streak. I think that's why indie suits me so much. But I don't like having to deliver things at certain points. Like, I like, anyway, whatever, but I'm giving this up because I started this podcast in March 2009. And for 6 years, I have put out the show basically whenever I feel like it, which has been, you know, it was weekly, then it was bi-weekly, then it was just kind of like whenever. And I've never had a set schedule. I never know how to pronounce that because Americans do it differently. But it's kind of been more casual. But I've decided that times are a-changing and I need to be more professional with my podcasting. What's so funny, of course, is I started podcasting before it was trendy. I'm always a little early on the old curve. And March 2009, podcasting was really not a big thing. So of course, nowadays, if you want to start a podcast, there's all these tips on how to do it, and everyone's super professional and launching things and making like $100,000 a month. Well, most people are not making that. Let's be fair. Most people are podcasting for the love of it, as I have done for years. From now on, the show will go out every Monday because some of the other days are taken by some of the other self-publishing podcasts. The show will go out on Monday and some shows will just be me answering questions as well as the interviews, because I've had some feedback. I just did this survey. If you missed out, no worries. I do one every year. But I have over 2,000 questions that people submitted on the survey. And many of them are very interesting questions. So what I'm going to do is try and answer some of those in the, as Tim Ferriss says, the in-between episodes. So I will be doing that. Thanks to everyone who entered the survey and for all your questions, and congratulations to AM in Australia, who wins the $50 voucher. And I may open up like a Q&A thing. I won't be doing Steve Scott like a regular daily show. That's just way too much production. But a weekly show on a Monday, that is it. So I hope that's good news for you guys who enjoy the show, which I hope is all of you. And I'm also doing this, you know, while I do want to be more professional and have everybody know when the show's coming out, but also I don't want to write so much on the blog. When I do blog now, I do like a mega post, and so that basically not writing so regularly on the blog. But I still do mega posts, and one just went up today. It's called The Pros and Cons of Being an Indie Author, and it's a bit of a rant, which isn't so much like me. I don't rant very much. But I was at Crime Fest in Bristol last weekend, and essentially what happened was I met a whole load of traditionally published authors, and what's happening now is people are being more accepting of indies in Britain, and you know, traditionally it's been quite a traditional place, and there's been some sort of negativity, but now that's definitely changed. And I was talking to a lot of people privately, and I was just really shocked at how disempowered many traditionally published authors are. And I really do feel, I'm not militant about indie, I know it's not for everyone, I am militant about empowering authors and creatives, because you know, many of these authors were saying, oh, my agent wouldn't let me do that, or my publisher wants me to write something different. They want me to change the story to be more like this. And I can't understand why people will, you know, wait for permission, essentially, you know, just very disempowered. So I wrote this post about really how indie is more about the startup mentality. It's about creative control, it's about empowerment, it's about taking steps, and also, you know, not asking permission, not waiting to be chosen, but choosing yourself. So I hope you guys feel empowered, and if you don't, then go check out The Pros and Cons of an Indie Author, which was published on the 22nd of May 2015. Ah, which is today, as I'm recording this. Oh, there you go. Anyway, what else? Let me think. Okay, update, little update. I am in the home stretch of Deviance. 53,000 words in and a week to go before I go on holiday, and I will be finishing the first draft before then. Luckily, my books are quite short. They're around 65,000 words. I tend to write in a much, you know, kind of tightly paced manner, so that I will finish. I'm getting terrible RSI in my elbow at the moment, though, so we shall see. But it will happen, even if I have to peck with my left hand. What else? Oh, yes, I'm also writing a shorter, more targeted book on how I make a six-figure living with my writing, and that will be How to Make a Living with Your Writing, another original original non-fiction book title. That will probably be out in June, and Deviance will be out in July, because that will need a lot more editing. On audiobooks, I'm super excited because Gates of Hell will be out soon in audio, narrated by the lovely Veronica Giguère, and it has Spain and flamenco and Kabbalah and scuba diving in the Dead Sea and fight scenes and awesome demons, and so that is a really fun book, and that will be hopefully out in June. And then One Day in New York is also under development as an audiobook, and as it's a male point of view, it is my first male narrator for an audiobook, and the brilliant Jeffrey Kafer, who does a lot of thrillers, is narrating it. And it was so funny when I listened to him reading the book the other day, and I was just kind of mesmerized. It's really weird to hear a male voice speak my words. I don't know why it's so weird, but it's the first time it's happened for me. So it was weird, but it's actually strangely sexy. So yeah, I shall try and play an excerpt when that's available, I think. Yeah. Anyway, back to regular segment, which is what are you doing while listening to the show? And I've had some tweets and some emails, so just to run through those. So Honoré listens at the gym. Marshall listens while lettering comic books. Gillian listens while working at a graphic design firm. It's a great way to tune out co-workers while staying informed. Thank you, Gillian. Deborah. Oh, this is a good one. Deborah listens to the podcast while cleaning the llama barn, knitting or spinning homemade yarn. I love that. So hello to the llamas, Deborah. Charles was listening the other day whilst driving to an interview for a volleyball coaching job. Joel listens while doing the dishes. Good man, Joel. Rhonda listens while driving around. I like that. Rhonda, do you just go for a drive when the show comes on? And Christopher listens on the way to work. So that's super. I really like hearing from everybody and where you are when you listen to the show. Oh, wait, a couple more. I just paged down on my notes here. Edwin listens to the podcast in the car during his commute or at work during morning walkabout. Monica usually listens on the commute, but today while packing for vacation. And I think the winner of interesting places, probably because I'm so obsessed with tattoos right now, Sai was listening to the latest episode whilst being tattooed, so that's cool. I imagine you don't do it every week, Sai, but I have actually, and I'll tell you guys this, you know, because we're all friends here, I haven't told anybody else yet. I've told my husband I want a tattoo, but I have now decided what I want to get tattooed, and I am now in the process of finding a tattoo artist in London. For some reason, this feels like some strange relationship that I need to be, you know, sort of actively choose. I don't just want to go to a random place and get it. You know, so this is a big deal. And if you have read my London psychic series, Desecration and Delirium so far, and Deviance, will be going further into it. But I'm super obsessed with tattoos. So it's time I got one. And of course, I'm 40. It's about time I got a tattoo. Anyway, moving on. This podcast episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and we'll have a word from our sponsor in a minute. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks in particular to new supporter Catherine Saxelby. And on Patreon, you can support me with a few dollars, even just $1 per show, to a maximum of 2 shows a month. So less than a coffee a month. And of course, now I'm going to be doing 4 shows a month. You'll be getting a really good deal because I only do 2 paid a month. You can support the show if you like at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or of course, you can buy my books. Thank you so much. Let's get on with a word from our sponsor and then the interview.
Hey, Creative Pen fans! This is Camille Mofidi, the European Manager for Kobo Writing Life, based in Paris. Did you know you could publish and sell your ebooks very easily all over the world with Kobo, reaching an international audience in 190 countries? Plus, you can now benefit from 2 brand new features on our website, readers' reviews and series numbers that will help raising awareness and visibility for all your books. For more details, please visit our blog www.kobowritinglife.com, where these features are fully presented. Thank you for listening, and now back to your wonderful host, Joanna.
And today I'm here with Michael Brent Collings. Hi, Michael Brent.
How are you guys doing?
Oh, good. This is going to be a fun show.
I hope so.
Oh, no, it is. Absolutely. But just a little introduction to anyone who might not know who you are. Michael Brent is an award-winning and internationally best-selling horror novelist, a number one bestseller in the US, and also a screenwriter and martial artist. And I'm a real fan of your books, as I've just been telling you. So it's awesome to have you on the show. But first, tell us a bit more about you and your writing background.
That's an open question. I guess about me and my writing background is, I, like a lot of horror writers, I grew up miserable and had to excise my demons by killing false people, because if you do the real thing, you get put in jail for some reason. No, not really. My dad was a creative writing professor, and he was one of the world experts. He was the world expert on Stephen King. So if you have a Stephen King book in your school library or your college library, it's probably in large measure because of my dad. He was one of the first people who went out and said, this creepy guy isn't just a weirdo writing pulp fiction. He's writing literature. And so he wrote all these books about him and published the first full-length scholarly critiques of him. And so I went to bed every night with my dad's office in the next room. I had either screaming or typing or both. And it was just something I grew up with. You know, my dad would let me watch all these movies, and if it was a really intense part or a sex scene, he'd be like, go stand behind the, you know, behind the TV. But I just grew up with it. And then when I was a kid, I was small and I was very intelligent and I was abrasive, and those are a recipe for getting punched a lot, you know, and because of the small thing, I couldn't do anything about it. So I'd write like my little stories, and I'd be like, and then the bully died, you know, and so I grew up with it in the next room, and then it migrated over into therapy, and then eventually I started realizing how powerful a medium horror can be, and I started really kind of emphasizing that in my work. I write other stuff. I write science fiction, and I write thrillers, and I write all sorts of different things, but I keep coming back to horror as kind of as both a home base and something I understand, and also just something I find immensely gratifying and something that can be good for the world.
Mm. Oh, no, that's fascinating. And you know, obviously you've got a sense of humor as well.
Look, you've got to when you look like this, honey.
But what The first question I want to ask is about the horror genre, because I recently read The Darkness Light, and it starts off, and you think, and I thought, oh, why is this in horror? This is like a thriller, a mainstream thriller. But it pretty much, spirals into something which has a supernatural aspect. And, I think you can get away with a lot of murder in other genres. But I guess my question is, what defines horror for you, and what are the characteristics of the genre? Because certainly your book is not torture porn or anything like that,
right?
So to explore the edges of the genre for us.
Well, the best description and definition of horror on a really precise scale is whatever is on the horror shelf at Barnes & Noble. Because genre exists as it's a function of marketing. In the old days, there was just the novel. It was the new thing that came out. Nobody asked, oh, did you read the horror book Frankenstein? They said, have you read this novel Frankenstein? And now we have it kind of bifurcated up either in actual shelves, or Amazon puts them in its virtual shelves or what have you. And a lot of books that don't deserve to be in one place or the other end up there just because it's a marketing decision. But I do think when a lot of people think about horror, it's funny you mentioned torture porn, because people go, oh, I don't like horror. And you say, what don't you like about it? And when you really dig down, what they don't like is like the poster for Saw. Because they haven't seen any real horror movies or read any real horror books, but they have this kind of this image of, oh, it's that thing with a monster in the background who's chasing a girl whose bosom is about to pop out, and then there's blood. And that's kind of all they have. And if you look at it really carefully, the most gory books I know of aren't horror, they're war novels. And the most sexualized books aren't horror, they're romance and 50 Shades of Grey and things like that. And so everything that people don't like about horror is found somewhere else, more so. So horror is very much just an image we have created. I think for me, when I'm talking about my horror, I'm talking about a story that takes people and it cuts everything away that's extraneous. It takes away everything but their sense of self, and it does it through tragedy. In a thriller, you're running away from something, and there's the sense that you have to stay ahead of possible tragedy. And I think in horror, you start out with tragedy having already occurred, and the threat then becomes loss of self, damnation. It's not the best horror isn't just nubile teens in the forest banging away until somebody cuts their head off, which I don't understand that, because I've never been a nubile teen in that position, but I am like a family man, and a lot of my stories revolve around families, because I think what would be the worst thing to happen would be to lose them. And so horror, I think what it does is it really incisively takes away everything extraneous about people and then says, okay, this is your core. You don't have your job. You don't have your money. You don't have even your relationships, because horror always isolates people. So it takes away everything but you, and then says, now you're going to live or die based on your own merit and perhaps a touch of grace. And that's the area that I also find very fascinating, because you get to talk about grace and about God. And, if there's a girl possessed by a demon, a guy in a priest's outfit walks in, and casts her out by the power of God. And those are things you can't do in any other genre nearly to the same extent. You can't talk about these huge questions, even like, Dan Brown in The Da Vinci Code, and he's kind of ruminating around what really happened to Jesus, but it's all played out in a very low key sort of way. The adventure is ridiculous, and I liked it. It's fun, but it's ridiculous adventure. And then the supernatural aspects are very dumbed down at the end. Whereas in horror, you can go like, no, man, we're going to ask a question whether this prophetess is of God or the devil, and she'll either save us or damn us. And it's really cool stuff that you can do.
Yeah, it's funny because I've been on the BSAT categories, that drive what's on Amazon and things.
Yeah.
We've been on a bit of a campaign, a few of us, to get the thriller-supernatural added, and they now have added it. And this, when I was reading your book, because I always have supernatural elements, so I think, well, I write supernatural thriller. But when I read your books, I've been reading, some of the James Herbert uh-huh. stuff. Uh-huh. I just read Sepulchre again. It's like a book I keep going back to because I really like it. And it's, again, that supernatural element. But I don't think there's much of a line between a supernatural thriller and a horror, in a way. You know what I mean?
No. Yeah, I agree. And again, it's like a lot of these books, they get put on this shelf because that's where they'll sell. You know, it's like Stephen King writes an awful lot of literary fiction. I mean, if you think about The Body, which was the basis for Stand By Me, or even Shawshank Redemption, they're not horror stories. They're very literary, this is what happens in this particular place to normal people sort of stories. But if you stick Stephen King's book over on literary fiction shelf, it's just going to sit there until somebody grabs it and puts it where it belongs, you know?
Yeah, because he's become that brand, and I agree with you. A lot of his books are not what one would call horror anymore. That's just where he got stuck. But but no, that's really interesting. And then it's fascinating about your dad, because you mentioned he was a professor, and this kind of issue that people have between literary fiction and genre fiction. You know, and have you ever had? Because my mum was also an English teacher, and I went to Oxford.
Oh no,
I know. And I went to Oxford, and I was brought up. And my mother-in-law says, "Why don't I write like Hilary Mantel?" And I'm like, so I come up against this all the time. Have you had to get over any kind of write something more literary type of thing?
No.
Or, you know?
You know, I'm self-published, so, and I've been very blessed in a lot of ways to be self-published, because it means I don't have to listen to somebody telling me what to do. I listen to my fans, and they get irritated when I wander from horror for too many books. So like, I'll write a horror novel and then a sci-fi and then a horror and then a YA or whatever. But other than that general, like, write scary stuff, Michael Brent, I don't have people telling me that stuff. And if somebody said, well, why don't you write more literary fiction? I think that I have sentences in my books that are tremendously lyrical. So I think there's definitely times where people want that sense of, oh, I want something deep and I want something, you know, very, very lyrical sounding. And I think I put those things there. My father taught poetry for 40 years. I mean, like, it's in my blood to some extent. But I also, and this is just me, I'm not ripping on anybody else, but I don't get entertained and I don't personally enjoy books where people sit around a tea cozy and talk about their adulterous affairs and, you know, wax effervescent on the dew on the spider web. You know, it's just, okay, well, you banged the wrong people and you're having tea and there's a wet spider web. Like I said, the whole book in three sentences, you know. And just for me personally, I like something that has some movement to it. So my books do have a lot of plot to them. They're very plot driven, but you know, the best stories are always where plot and character intersect on a great level, and you find out about people and you find out what they're doing, and then books are given to us so that we can make sense of some universe. And if you're doing that, there's a tremendous artistic value there. I mean, Spencer, the guy who wrote the Spencer books, he can't write a sentence of more than six words. I think he's just like, you know, he's Hemingway, he's very short, but everything in them is so dense and compacted. Some of the sentences are just beautiful, you know? And so I think it's erroneous to say, oh, you have to be more literary. Oh, you have to be more plot driven. I think you just should look at a book and say, this is something I like and here's why I'll recommend it. Or it's not for me. And maybe other people like it. I try not to be too catty about that.
I agree with you. People like what they like. But yeah, I certainly couldn't put your book down, which to me, that, you know, that's important. I'm really fascinated with self-censorship. It's something with my book Desecration I've talked about before on my show, but you know, to write Desecration I had to overcome some self-censorship issues around what a nice girl should write, and the fear of judgment of how people judge our writing. Have you come up against this self-censorship or fear of judgment? How do you overcome that?
No, I'm a religious person. I'm a believing guy. And part of that is that ultimately my status with God is between me and God. And I belong to a religion that I believe teaches true precepts. But even within that kind of rubric, it ultimately comes down to, you know, if God walked into the room, could I stand there and be okay looking at him? And so one of the rules, I have three rules that I have for writing, which I think you can't break. And the first is, confuse me and lose me. Like, if you just don't have a sense of what's going on, the audience is going to leave. The second is bore me and die, because we want interesting stuff. And it can be an interesting book about the dew on the spider web. Some people have that capacity. But the third is leave the world a better place. And I think sometimes it's you can do that telling scary, awful stories, because those are morality tales about what should and should not be. And that's totally legitimate. And that's different from self-censorship. Self-censorship is this sort of extraneous concern about what will others think of me. Whereas if you go in there with okay, this is my dynamic, I'm going to try and create pieces that once somebody's done with them, their world will have been edified. And once I say that, well, I'm not self-censoring. What I'm doing is guiding my words properly to that effect, which I'm trying to achieve. And it's a lot more freeing to think of it that way rather than what will my mom think of it?
Oh, yeah.
Or things like, well, you know, because my mommy reads my stuff. She's a mom, you know, and there are certainly things where I go, Mom, you're not going to like this one. Just skip it, you know. And there's one book of mine that my wife hasn't read because I said, you're not going to like the subject matter. And I told her what it was and she said, never mind, you know. But I felt good about both of those books. I felt good about writing them because I thought they served a purpose beyond just let's fling words at the internet and see what sticks.
Mm. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I don't have your faith. I have a spirituality, you know, I don't have, but good versus evil to me, I think is why I read horror, because I feel, especially when good wins at the end, which, yeah. You know, it does in your book, you know, and I was like, you know, yay, you can feel good, even though there is a lot of casualties along the way, you know, that, and that's with Stephen King, like I feel, you know, The Stand being my favorite book, although at the end he kind of puts a glimmer of good, you know, might not have won. But that kind of good versus evil, I feel, underlies the horror genre, doesn't it?
Yeah,
really?
It absolutely does. And The Stand's great. And it's great that you notice that you get the feeling good might not have won. And I don't think he's sitting there, you know, behind his keyboard going, and now I shall cut out the throat of their hope, you know. But he's writing something that people can hold on to, which is, I mean, you look around your world and you know good people who've been injured unfairly. You know bad people who are getting ahead unfairly. And so I think Stephen King, very often, and I do this in some of my books too, you get the feeling the fight is still going on. Just because they've won this battle doesn't mean we get to sit and rest on our laurels. And I think that's really powerful too, because we live our lives not just in this moment, but in the future and an expectation of what's going to come tomorrow. And so if we are led to believe everything's great today and is going to be great from here on out, you know, and they lived happily ever after, that's a fantastic and fun message to noodle over with your kids, you know, because they need that. But when you grow up, if someone says, and then you'll live happily ever after, your reaction is, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I'm going to be constipated, or, you know, I'm going to lose my job, or some major or minor mishap is going to befall me, because that's life. And so I think when we layer in this sort of melancholy ending, where even when good has won, there's still a sense there's evil left, I think that serves a great purpose to say, look, the fights are worth fighting. Even if you can't see the end of the war, these battles are necessary and they're worthy and they're good. And so do partake of the opportunity to be a warrior in good versus evil. You know, whether you're religious or not, most people have a moral center that says there's good and there's bad. And horror very often says, and the bad guys won. But the bad guys won because the good guys stopped being good, or because tomorrow there's going to be another battle. And I think that's marvelous.
Yeah. No, I love it anyway. But let's move on. well, you know, staying on the dark side. But I talked to fellow horror writer Jay Thorne about how writing some of this stuff heals us. And you talked a bit about bullying, about, you know, and you've got on your blog about depression. And, you know, I wondered, you know, how does writing help you through those kind of dark moments? And, you know, do you have any sort of tips for people to write through that time?
Well, on a very nuts and bolts sort of a level, it gives me something to do. I mean, one of the major things about depression is you crawl in your bed and you just don't want to leave. But I always have a story that I'm excited about, you know, and that's something that I can control. A lot of us really hunger for control in our lives, and that's why we acquire money, and that's why we accrue friends and things like that. It's less about their intrinsic value than it is about the idea that now I control this kingdom. And writing is a wonderful thing for that, because you can control it. I mean, even if you go and your computer breaks and then you find out you're out of paper and all your pens have sprung leaks, you know, like you walk outside and you can get a stick and you start writing in the dirt. You can always write. And that's a good thing to have it's always good to have a project that will lead you into the future, because if you're done 100% today and depression hits you, well, why not kill yourself? Because there's nothing to do tomorrow anyways. So just on a very nuts and bolts sort of base level, it's something to do. It's a good hobby to have. But beyond that, like this actually ties into what we were talking about earlier. I do have a lot of days where I don't see, just because of chemical imbalances, I don't see a purpose, and I certainly don't have hope. And that's not because I don't want to be hopeful. It's just that's because my brain's broken in that way. Some of what my writing does for me is it reminds me, you know, there are all these characters that I wrote, and I wrote them so that they would go through horrific events and then come through it. And in the middle of their horrors, if they know it's going to be all right in the end, then the horror has no validity. Who cares? You know, if you're standing there being run after by the superhuman guy with the axe or the machete, but you know he's got a bad heart and he's going to die 6 steps before he gets to you, well, then it's not a horror movie. It's just a weird commercial for machetes, you know. But because I've had those horrific elements in my books and those characters who have to keep going, not for hope, but for the hope of future hope, that allows me to kind of think about it on an intellectual level. Look, I don't have hope today. I might not have it tomorrow. But I understand non-emotively that if I keep pushing, things should get better. And that's a message of a lot of my horror, which is basically just keep pushing and things will eventually get better.
No, that's great. And, you know, something else is that you're a screenwriter, which, you know, I also find I'm fascinated with right now. And amusingly, I've recently written a treatment about my book Desecration.
Awesome.
Yeah. It was awesome. But I thought it was awesome. But then I got the feedback that it was too disturbing and too disturbing for TV, and that it would need to be kind of redone. And I'm like, well, the book's already written. I'm not going to redo this at this point. So I wondered, you know, from somebody, you know, writing what you do, what do you think the market is like for darker material? Because it seems to me that there is a lot around, you know, the world is pretty dark. And also, you know, comment on adapting books, or, you know, should you do that, or should you write something new?
Well, as far as the market for horror is always there. It's a fantastic market because it's cheap and there's a built-in fan base. I mean, you will not see Avengers Sleepaway Camp 7, you know, because they're not going to spend $200 million on a horror movie. But you can get a bunch of, all too often it is these scantily clad teens, and you throw them in a sleeping bag together. And yeah, but it costs 85 cents to make the movie. And so it's a no brainer for a lot of Hollywood executives. They go, okay, we've got Avengers 4 coming up, and that's using up $280 million of our 284. What should we do with the last four? Let's make a horror movie. And so I have friends who are producers that they put together slates of $100 million, and they say, we're going to make 10 or 15 movies with this $100 million. And the investors love that because it's a safe bet. You know, even if you make a $2 million movie that sucks, it doesn't have to have that much traction to make that money back. So there's always a market for horror. That within the market, there's a lot of shift. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, it was all about Scream. And then 10 years ago, it was Saw was kind of the big horse on the stage, you know. And now it's very much about the ghosts and the Paranormal Activity sort of handheld stuff. The guy who made that first one, the first Paranormal Activity movie, he really changed the way Hollywood functions on a lot of levels, because he went in and he made this thing for, you know, $17,000, and it made $100 million in the theaters. And so people are looking for those inexpensive films to make. Now, if you show up and you're pitching the Avengers versus zombies, you're not going to get very far, because they don't want big event horror movies. They want things that can be shot inexpensively with limited locations. And if you make it really full of cool scenery chewing stuff, they like that because they can send it to actors and the actors enjoy it. So like one of my books is called Strangers, and I wrote a screenplay based off of it. And it's about a family that wakes up one morning and they have been sealed into their home. All the windows have sheet metal over them. The doors are all barred and they can't get out. And there's a guy in there who wants to have some alone time with them. And I give it to the studios and I give it to producers, and they all love it because it's contained and it's cheap and it's got six people in it. And they each get to have really cool dialogue about how scared they are, and it's something that they go nuts over. So I've optioned that thing like three or four times now. And it's going to sell eventually. It's one of those that's just kind of waiting for the right home. So horror is a great thing to write. You do have to be aware of the market. I have, you know, three or four of my books and my screenplays are ghost stories. And because of the Paranormal Activity stuff, ghost stories are actually kind of hard to sell right now, because it's so dominated by this one production company, and they're putting everything out. And if you want to do something, it's got to be really, really different. So you kind of have to be aware of the vicissitudes of the current market, but it's a great market to write for, because there's always people there who want horror.
And so did you start out screenwriting or start out with novels? Like, how did you cross over?
I did both at the same time. I've been writing since I was very young, and I didn't start writing screenplays, you know, at age four, like I started writing my little Crayola books, you know. But when I was in high school, a friend brought a copy of the manuscript, or of the screenplay for Terminator 2, and I read it and I was like, this is amazing. I mean, it's a totally different way of telling stories. And I thought, I can do this too. So I've kind of grown up together with them. My first screenplay I wrote when I was in high school still, and my first book I wrote around the same time. And since then, whenever I do a book, I almost always have a screenplay version of it as well. It's just a good way to monetize my work, you know, because like I can sell two versions of it.
Well, see, that's brilliant. And let's come on to that. The monetize my work is, it's great that you say that though, because you're writing the funny thing with horror, it seems mainstream, but it's not mainstream. It's smaller, you know, than it is. And there are Uber fans, and then there are people like me who I would say are kind of half in, half out fans, you know. I like some things and not other things, you know. But you do make a living as a writer, and you have some great stuff on your blog about, you know, about the numbers and living, you know, writing for a living. So can you maybe talk about, you know, your opinions on that and how, because so many writers say, oh, I want to make a living writing, but then they just like write one book. So how do you knit it all together?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I think the two things you need, to be successful, and by successful, I mean to be making money, because success, I prefer people not to think about that. It's success is the end of the rainbow. It's always going to move away from you, no matter how close you get. You're never going to reach success, because when you become a bestseller, you'll want to be a number one bestseller, and then you'll be a number one, and you'll want, you know, and then you want to make a movie out of it, and then you want to write, and it's always one step past you. So what you do is you create concrete goals. I want to make this much money per year as a writer. I want to, for me, provide for my family as a writer. That's my goal. I'm a huge whore. So like all I'm interested in is the money. But a lot of writers don't do that. They don't have a concrete goal. And then after that, the way to achieve those goals is almost always a function of two things, product and people. And by that, I mean, you write lots and lots and lots and lots of stuff, and you meet lots and lots and lots and lots of people, and eventually one of those people wants your product as a screenplay, or one of those people wants this book as a traditionally published book, or whatever it is. But you really accrete these two things. You have a growing body of work, and you have a growing body of people who you know who are in that industry and who are moneymakers, who are gatekeepers. And I use the word accrete purposefully, because that's a descriptor for choral growth. You know, it's very, very slow. These two things There's no silver bullet. It's a product of time. You get one person here at a convention. You write a book over 6 months. You meet another person at a writing symposium. And a lot of the people you meet, they're not going to be useful to you. But then they are one day. You know, someday, the guy you met at the symposia is no longer the person bringing coffee to the producer. He's the producer. And you've kept up with him long enough, and you have a relationship so that he's saying, hey, send me every single thing you've got. And that's a relationship I have with a lot of producers. I finish a script and I, you know, send it out in a bulk mail. Here you go. It's up for grabs. Knock yourselves out. But that took 10 years to get those contacts. And it really, there's nothing special about it. You know, you scour the internet and you cold call people and you mostly you meet people at symposia and at comic cons and things like that, because it's face to face is going to have the most effect. Mm. And then you write and write and write. Forbes did a really interesting survey of the most successful writers monetarily in history. And there were no common grounds between them, except with the exception of a few outliers, they all had a huge body of work written over a long period of time. Mm. And so, like, I wrote a book called Run, and it did really well. It was a number one bestseller on Amazon. And that made me think I knew what I was doing, which was a huge disservice to me. Because the next book didn't make any money, and the next book didn't make any money. And then 10 books later, I was making some money. And 15 books later, I was making decent money. And now I'm like 30 books in, and I'm a writer, and I get to just sit around with my pants off all day and type if I feel like it, you know? How's that for a horrific image?
I'd say you type quite a lot, actually.
I do. I do type a lot. But, you know, but that's the thing is people – here's another thing I like to say is people – if you go to the doctor and he's about to poke a finger in some hole that you don't like fingers being poked in, and you say, so where'd you go to school? And he goes, I didn't really go to school per se, but I went to a doctor once and he was terrible, so I figured I can do better than him. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to be gone. There's going to be like a little smoke outline of you in the doctor's office, and you're out of there because you don't want to be poked by that guy. But that's the way a lot of writers pursue their writing career. They say, well, I read a book once and it sucked, so I thought I'd barf up my own little set of word crap, and some magical publisher is going to come along and scoop it up, and gold will rain upon me, you know? And in reality, if you want to be successful, you treat it like medical school. You write after work for 8 hours a day. I was a lawyer for about 10 years before I became a full-time writer. And I would get up at 6. I'd go to work until 6 or 7. I'd come home. I'd play with my kids. I'd play with my wife at 10 or 11. She'd go to bed, and I would write until 2 a.m. And I did that every day for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Most people are like, I'm going to be a writer. Well, how are you going to do that? I'll write a book like during summer and then never think of it again. You know, and that's just not enough. Yeah. And you know what? And it happens occasionally, but even to the people that it happens to, they run into problems because they've got all this money, and then eventually the money dries up, which it has to. And this person doesn't know how to replicate that success, because what they did was they succeeded by accident. And you want to not only succeed, you want to know how you did it so that you can replicate that success. Again, this first book I wrote, it did really well. And I had no freaking clue why no one was buying the other one.
It's so common. I mean, we see that, especially, I mean, I feel sorry for debut novelists, you know, who get the first book that they're cared about, and the second book, nobody cares.
Yeah.
It really is. But I do want to come back on what you said. You said a couple of things that I know some people will be scared of, which is meet people and cold call. I mean, because, you know, I'm an introvert and I really struggle at events, but Twitter's my secret weapon, as in I stalk people and generally make friends first, and then when I talk to them it's much easier because they actually know I exist. But I wondered if you had any tips for the meeting people stuff naturally in a good way.
Well, there's a couple things. Number one is, if you're a writer and if you've written a book, recognize the fact that you are the world's foremost frickin' expert on that book, you know? And so a lot of writers that I meet, they come up to me and they're very pensive and they're very worried, and it looks like they're worried I'm going to punch them just for existing. And the reality is, you are a world expert in this thing and you're competent to talk about it. And if you can kind of have that in your mindset, it's a lot easier to move forward. Because what we're afraid of, when I'm an introvert too, obviously, I've got this depression and stuff. And when I go to conventions, I come home and I sit in a dark room for a full day because and I shake because it scares me. But you go up with this sense of, I know what I'm talking about. And that's very helpful. And then the other thing to remember is try and picture the other person like someone you're meeting at a dinner party, and you pull out your wallet and you show them all the pictures of your children. And this is a small slice of hell for that other person because they don't give a crap about your kids. They don't know about it. They, you know, I don't care that Johnny lost his tooth. I could care less. Now, if he lost his face, I'd be interested because that's an interesting story. And the mistake a lot of novelists do that they make when they go to these conventions, they approach somebody and they say, I want to talk to you about my novel. Good start. Chapter one, page one. We open in a very dark place, not as dark as your room, but a little lighter than outside. But it's kind of creepy, you know, and it's like 60 minutes later, this person that you're talking to just wants to kill themselves because you're showing your baby pictures without any context. If you walk over to my table, I've got 20 books and I can tell you the basic idea of all of them in under 2 minutes total. And then that allows the other person to be invested. He can ask you. So like, before we were talking on air, you asked, what should I read next? And I didn't say, oh, I'll read this because it's so awesome. I said, well, do you want to read about monsters, serial killers, ghosts, or demons? And then you get to answer. And now you're leading the conversation and I'm not selling you anything. I'm just supplying your need. And that's a much better situation to be in. So rather than go, here's my baby pictures, blah, you know, just vomit stuff on them, say, what are you looking for? And they tell you. And then you say, here's what I've got that fits that. And if you don't have something that fits that, you go, well, coincidentally, I'm writing something right now that fits that, you know, because – and you have to do that. I've been in pitch sessions where they went for movies where I was trying to sell a movie and the producer goes, that's not what we're looking for. And I say, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to waste your time. What are you looking for? And they go, you know, we're looking for a movie about lesbian dogs from space. And I'm like, I'm just writing one of those, you know. And even if they don't end up buying the idea, you've made that contact who thinks you are awesome because you have this joint affection for lesbian dogs from space. And that becomes a friend. And in 10 years, he'll want something that you're actually writing.
So I guess the trick there is to always focus on the other person and not yourself. And I agree with you. So many people, I mean, like I get pitched, you know, pitched all the time by people wanting, you know, to come on the podcast or for me to endorse stuff or whatever. And they just don't even consider who I am. Like, so I get pitched for credit cards and stuff like that. And I'm like, what's that got to do with anything? You know, these just spam.
You have to ask yourself, you know, this is a service industry. And I mean that in two senses. One, it's like a restaurant. You're giving them what they want to eat. And two, I really believe writers are serving humanity. We are writing, hopefully, good things that edify on some level, that uplift on some level, that help people. And so if someone comes to you and says, I need help, and you say, I can help you, you're best friends now. I mean, it's just the nature of civilization. If somebody comes up to you and says, I need help, and you go, let me tell you something I want to tell you first, and then we'll talk about your needs. That's not a friendship, and that's not something that's going to work well for you. And also, just when you're helping somebody, I mean, if there's an old lady on the side of the road with her tire flat, and you jack up the car and fix the tire, you never see that old lady again, but you go home and you're like, honey, I was the bomb today, and you feel good about yourself. And it's exactly the same when you're pitching your materials if you take the time to find out what they want first and then address that desire rather than going in and saying, well, I've got my favorite book and I'm going to pitch it and they're going to love it or else, well, there is no other else. Yeah. You know, you've got to be able to ask what they want and do that.
And it does get much easier the more books you have because you care. You don't care as much about each individual project when you have so many. You know, it's like that children metaphor. I just laugh about that now. I mean, you've got some real children, but also books. And you don't, once you get over, I don't know, 6, 10 books, you don't call books your children.
No.
I mean,
No, and
because that's ridiculous. That's
very true. No, and that's silly. The faster you can get over that, the better. One of my screenplays came out, or the movie was finished, and I watched it, and it was not a good experience because they had changed some things, and it just wasn't my screenplay anymore. And I walked out, and people go, "Wasn't that devastating for you?" And I said, "You know what? Kind of sucked because my name was on this movie that I didn't think was very good." But my first thought wasn't they killed my babies. When I walked out and the producers were all lined up because it was a screening, and they said, "What did you think?" And my first thought wasn't, "You murdered my baby." My first thought was, "Their check cleared and it was big. How can I be happy about this?"
I loved it. Let's do it again.
You know, without lying, how can I approach this? Because it's not my baby, it's my product. And that's another thing that's helpful. If you go in there thinking, "I'm a business," and instead of putting greeting cards on a table or hamburgers in, wrapping, I put books out. And they mean exactly as much as those hamburgers and those greeting cards. They bring people pleasure. They help them get through the day. Hopefully they make them a little healthier on some level. But it's just a hamburger, man, and I can't get that freaked out about it. Because when people get freaked out about it, this is the most important work in English literature. It's going to go downhill from there.
That's true. So where can people find you and your books online?
Well, my name's Michael Brent, and that's my first name. So if you type in Michael Brent, all one word, you're going to get my Amazon page and my website. My website's michaelbrentcollings.com. But I'm really easy to find. Just type Michael Brent. Although there is an underwear model whose name is Michael space Brent. So if you type it in and you get this devastating dude with no clothes, that's not me. But michaelbrentcollings.com, or just type Michael Brent on your Amazon browser, Barnes & Noble, or wherever.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.